"How old are you?" I asked, when we had the baby squared away and were back at a safe distance. She gave me a look. Tired or not, she had it together again. "Old enough to know the situation I'm in." She held out her hand. "Thanks again, Mr. Noonan. God sent you along at the right time." "Nah, God just told me I needed a hamburger at the village cafe," I said. "Or maybe it was his opposite number. Please say Buddy's still doing business at the same old stand." She smiled. It warmed her face back up again, and I was happy to see it. "He'll still be there when Kai's kids are old enough to try buying beer with fake IDs, unless someone wanders in off the road and asks for something like shrimp tetrazzini. If that happened, he'd probably drop dead of a heart attack." "Yeah. When I get copies of the new book, I'll drop one off." The smile continued to hang in there, but now it shaded toward caution. "You don't need to do that, Mr. Noonan." "No, but I will. My agent gets me 50 comps. I find that as I get older, they go further." Perhaps she heard more in my voice than I had meant to put there. People do sometimes, I guess. "All right. I'll look forward to it." I took another look at the baby, sleeping in that queerly casual way they have, her head tilted over on her shoulder, her lovely little lips pursed and blowing a bubble. Their skin is what kills me. So fine and perfect, there seems to be no pores at all. Her socks hat was askew. Maddie watched me reach in and readjust it so the visor's shade fell across her closed eyes. "Kyra," I said. Maddie nodded. "Ladylike." "Kaya is an African name," I said. "It means season's beginning." I left her then, giving her a little wave as I headed back to the driver's side of the Chevy. I could feel her curious eyes on me, and I had the oddest feeling that I was going to cry. That feeling stayed with me long after the two of them were out of sight, was still with me when I got to the village cafe. I pulled into the dirt parking lot to the left of the off-brand gas pumps and just sat there for a little while, thinking about Joe and about a home pregnancy testing kit which had cost $22.50, a little secret she'd wanted to keep until she was absolutely sure. That must have been it. What else could it have been? "Kaya," I said, "season's beginning." But that made me feel like crying again, so I got out of the car and slammed the door hard behind me, as if I could keep the sadness inside that way. Buddy Jellison was just the same, all right. Same dirty cook's whites and splotchy white apron. Same flyaway gray hair under a paper cap stained with either beef blood or strawberry juice. Even, from the look, the same oatmeal cookie crumbs caught in his ragged mustache. He was maybe 55 and maybe 70, which in some genetically favored men seems to be still within the farthest borders of middle age. He was huge and shambly, probably 6'4", 300 pounds, and just as full of grace, wit, and joie de vivre as he had been 4 years before. "You want a menu, or do you remember?" he grunted, as if I'd last been in yesterday. "You still make the village burger deluxe? Does a crow still shit in the pine tops?" Pale eyes regarding me. No condolences, which was fine by me. "Most likely. I'll have one with everything. A village burger, not a crow. Plus a chocolate frap. Good to see you again." I offered my hand. He looked surprised, but touched it with his own. Unlike the whites, the apron and the hat, the hand was clean. Even the nails were clean. "Yeah," he said, then turned to the sallow woman chopping onions beside the grill. "Village burger, Audrey," he said. "Drag it through the garden." I'm ordinarily a sit-at-the-counter kind of guy, but that day I took a booth near the cooler and waited for Buddy to yell that it was ready. Audrey short orders, but she doesn't waitress. I wanted to think, and Buddy's was a good place to do it. There were a couple of locals eating sandwiches and drinking sodas straight from the can, but that was about it. People with summer cottages would have to be starving to eat at the village cafe, and even then you'd likely have to haul them through the door, kicking and screaming. The floor was faded red linoleum with a rolling topography of hills and valleys. Like Buddy's whites, it was none too clean. The summer people who came in probably failed to notice his hands. The woodwork was greasy and dark. Above it, where the plaster started, there were a number of bumper stickers, Buddy's idea of decoration. Horn broken, watch for finger. Wife and dog missing, reward for dog. There's no town drunk here, we all take turns. Humor is almost always anger with its makeup on, I think, but in little towns the makeup tends to be thin. Three overhead fans paddled apathetically at the hot air, and to the left of the soft drink cooler were two dangling strips of flypaper, both liberally stippled with wildlife, some of it still struggling feebly. If you can look at those and still eat, your digestion was probably doing okay. I thought about a similarity of names, which was surely, had to be, a coincidence. I thought about a young, pretty girl who had become a mother at 16 or 17 and a widow at 19 or 20. I thought about inadvertently touching her breast and how the world judged men in their 40s who suddenly discovered the fascinating world of young women and their accessories. Most of all, I thought of the queer thing that had happened to me when Maddie had told me the kid's name, that sense that my mouth and throat were suddenly flooded with cold, mineral-tangy water, that rush. When my burger was ready, Buddy had to call twice. When I went over to get it, he said, "You back to stay or to clear out?" "Why?" I asked. "Did you miss me, Buddy?" "No," he said. "But at least you're from in-state. Did you know that Massachusetts is Piscataqua for asshole?" "You're as funny as ever," I said. "Yeah, I'm going on fucking Letterman. Explain to him why God gave seagulls wings." "Why was that, Buddy?" "So they could beat the fucking Frenchman to the dump." I got a newspaper from the rack and a straw for my frap. Then I detoured to the payphone and, tucking my paper under my arm, opened the phone book. You could actually walk around with it if you wanted. It wasn't tethered to the phone. Who, after all, would want to steal a Castle County telephone directory? There were over 20 DeVores, which didn't surprise me very much. It's one of those names, like Pelkey or Bowie or Toothaker, that you kept coming across if you lived down here. I imagine it's the same everywhere. Some families breed more and travel less, that's all. There was a DeVore listing for R.D. Wasp Hill Road, but it wasn't for a Maddie, Matilda, Martha, or M. It was for Lance. I looked at the front of the phone book and saw it was a 1997 model, printed and mailed while Maddie's husband had still been in the land of the living. Okay, but there was something else about that name. DeVore. DeVore. Let us now praise famous DeVores. Wherefore art thou, DeVore? But it wouldn't come, whatever it was. I ate my burger, drank my liquefied ice cream, and tried not to look at what was caught on the flypaper. While I was waiting for the sallow, silent Audrey to give me my change, you could still eat all week in the village cafe for $50, if your blood vessels could stand it, that was. I read the sticker pasted to the cash register. It was another Buddy Jellison special. Cyberspace scared me so bad, I downloaded in my pants. This didn't exactly convulse me with mirth, but it did provide the key for solving one of the day's mysteries, why the name DeVore had seemed not just familiar, but evocative. I was financially well off, rich by the standards of many. There was at least one person with ties to the TR, however, who was rich by the standards of everybody, and filthy rich by the standards of most year-round residents of the Lakes region. If that was, he was still eating, breathing, and walking around. "Audrey, is Max DeVore still alive?" She gave me a little smile. "Oh, yeah, but we don't see him in here too often." That got the laugh out of me that all of Buddy's joke stickers hadn't been able to elicit. Audrey, who had always been yellowish and who now looked like a candidate for a liver transplant, snickered herself. Buddy gave us a librarian's prim glare from the far end of the counter, where he was reading a flyer about the holiday NASCAR race at Oxford Plains. I drove back the way I had come. A big hamburger is a bad meal to eat in the middle of a hot day. It leaves you feeling sleepy and heavy-witted. All I wanted was to go home. I'd been there less than 24 hours and was already thinking of it as home. Flop on the bed in the north bedroom under the revolving fan and sleep for a couple of hours. When I passed Wasp Hill Road, I slowed down. The laundry was hanging listlessly on the lines, and there was a scatter of toys in the front yard, but the scout was gone. Maddie and Kyra had donned their suities, I imagined, and headed on down to the public beachy. I liked them both, and quite a lot. Maddie's short-lived marriage had probably hooked her somehow to Max DeVore, but looking at the rusty double-wide trailer with its dirt driveway and balding front yard, remembering Maddie's baggy shorts and Kmart smock top, I had to doubt that the hook was a strong one. Before retiring to Palm Springs in the late 80s, Maxwell William DeVore had been a driving force in the computer revolution. It's primarily a young people's revolution, but DeVore did okay for a golden oldie, knew the playing field and understood the rules. He started when memory was stored on magnetic tape instead of in computer chips, and a warehouse-sized cruncher called UNIVAC was state-of-the-art. He was fluent in COBOL and spoke Fortran like a native. As the field expanded beyond his ability to keep up, expanded to the point where it began to define the world, he bought the talent he needed to keep growing. His company, Visions, had created scanning programs which could upload hard copy onto floppy disks almost instantaneously. It created graphic imaging programs which had become the industry standard. It created Pixel Easel, which allowed laptop users to mouse paint, to actually finger paint, if their gadget came equipped with what Joe had called the clitoral cursor. DeVore had invented none of this later stuff, but he'd understood that it could be invented and had hired people to do it. He held dozens of patents and co-held hundreds more. He was supposedly worth something like $600 million, depending on how technology stocks were doing on any given day. On the TR, he was reputed to be crusty and unpleasant. No surprise there. To a Nazarene, no good can come out of Nazareth. And folks said he was eccentric, of course. Listen to the old-timers who remember the rich and successful in their salad days, and all the old-timers claim they do, and you'll hear that they ate the wallpaper, fucked the dog, and showed up at church suppers wearing nothing but their pea-stained BVDs. Even if all that was true in DeVore's case, and even if he was Scrooge McDuck in the bargain, I doubted that he'd allow two of his closer relatives to live in a double-wide trailer. I drove up the lane above the lake, then paused at the head of my driveway, looking at the sign there. Sarah Laughs, burned into a length of varnished board nailed to a handy tree. It's the way they do things down here. Looking at it brought back the last dream of the Manderley series. In that dream, someone had slapped a radio station sticker on the sign, the way you're always seeing stickers slapped on turnpike toll collection baskets in the exact change lanes. I got out of my car, went to the sign, and studied it. No sticker. The sunflowers had been down there, growing out of the stoop. I had a photo in my suitcase that proved it, but there was no radio station sticker on the house sign. Proving exactly what? Come on, Noonan, get a grip. I started back to the car. The door was open, the Beach Boys spilling out of the speakers. Then changed my mind and went back to the sign again. In the dream, the sticker had been pasted just above the R.A. of Sarah and the L.A.U. of Laughs. I touched my fingers to that spot and thought they came away feeling slightly sticky. Of course, that could have been the feel of varnish on a hot day, or my imagination. I drove down to the house, parked, set the emergency brake, on the slopes around Darkscore and the dozen or so other lakes in western Maine, you always set your brake. And listen to the rest of Don't Worry, Baby, which I've always thought was the best of the Beach Boys songs. Great, not in spite of the sappy lyrics, but because of them. If you knew how much I love you, baby, Brian Wilson sings, nothing could go wrong with you. And, oh, folks, wouldn't that be a world? I sat there listening and looked at the cabinet set against the right side of the stoop. We kept our garbage in there to foil the neighborhood raccoons. Even cans with snap-down lids won't always do that. If the coons are hungry enough, they somehow manage the lids with their clever little hands. You're not going to do what you're thinking of doing, I told myself. I mean, are you? It seemed I was, or that I was at least going to have a go. When the Beach Boys gave way to Rare Earth, I got out of the car, opened the storage cabinet, and pulled out two plastic garbage cans. There was a guy named Frankie Prue who came down to yank the trash twice a week, or there was 4 years ago, I reminded myself, one of Bill Dean's far-flung network of part-timers working for cash off the books, but I didn't think Frankie would have been down to collect the current accumulation of swill because of the holiday, and I was right. There were two plastic garbage bags in each can. I hauled them out, cursing myself for a fool even while I was doing it, and untwisted the yellow ties. I really don't think I was so obsessed that I would have dumped a bunch of wet garbage out onto my stoop if it had come to that. Of course, I'll never know for sure, and maybe that's for the best. But it didn't. No one had lived in the house for 4 years, remember, and it's occupancy that produces garbage, everything from coffee grounds to used sanitary napkins. The stuff in these bags was dry trash swept together and carted out by Brenda Meserve's cleaning crew. There were 9 vacuum cleaner disposal bags containing 48 months of dust, dirt, and dead flies. There were wads of paper towels, some smelling of aromatic furniture polish and others of the sharper but still pleasant aroma of Windex. There was a moldy mattress pad and a silk jacket which had that unmistakable dined-upon-by-moths look. The jacket certainly caused me no regrets. A mistake of my young manhood, it looked like something from the Beatles' I Am the Walrus era. Goo Goo Jube, baby. There was a box filled with broken glass, another filled with unrecognizable and presumably out-of-date plumbing fixtures, a torn and filthy square of carpet, done-to-death dish towels, faded and ragged, the old oven gloves I'd used when cooking burgers and chicken on the barbecue. The sticker was in a twist at the bottom of the second bag. I'd known I would find it. From the moment I'd felt that faintly tacky patch on the sign, I'd known. But I'd needed to see it for myself, the same way old Doubting Thomas had needed to get the blood under his fingernails, I suppose. I placed my find on a board of the sun-warmed stoop and smoothed it out with my hand. It was shredded around the edges. I guessed Bill had probably used a putty knife to scrape it off. He hadn't wanted Mr. Noonan to come back to the lake after 4 years and discover some beard-up kid had slapped a radio station sticker on his driveway sign. Gorry, no, 'twouldn't be proper, dear. So off it had come, and into the trash it had gone, and here it was again, another piece of my nightmare, unearthed and not much the worse for wear. I ran my fingers over it. WBLM 102.9, Portland's Rock and Roll Blimp. I told myself I didn't have to be afraid, that it meant nothing, just as all the rest of it meant nothing. Then I got the broom out of the cabinet, swept all the trash together, and dumped it back in the plastic bags. The sticker went in with the rest. I went inside, meaning to shower the dust and grime away, then spied my own bathing suitie, still lying in one of my open suitcases, and decided to go swimming instead. The suit was a jolly number, covered with spouting whales that I had purchased in Key Largo. I thought my pal in the Bosox cap would have approved. I checked my watch and saw that I had finished my village burger 45 minutes ago. Close enough for government work, Kemosabe, especially after engaging in an energetic game of trash bag treasure hunt. I pulled on my suit and walked down the railroad tie steps which lead from Sarah to the water. My flip-flops snapped and flapped. A few late mosquitoes hummed. The lake gleamed in front of me, still and inviting under that low, humid sky. Running north and south along its edge, bordering the entire east side of the lake, was a right-of-way path. It's called common property in the deeds, which folks on the TR simply call the street. If one were to turn left onto the street at the foot of my steps, one could walk all the way down to the Dark Score Marina, passing Warrington's and Buddy Jellison's scuzzy little eatery on the way, not to mention 4 dozen summer cottages discreetly tucked into sloping groves of spruce and pine. Turn right and you could walk to Halo Bay, although it would take you a day to do it with the street overgrown the way it is now. I stood there for a moment on the path, then ran forward and leaped into the water. Even as I flew through the air with the greatest of ease, it occurred to me that the last time I had jumped in like this, I had been holding my wife's hand. Touching down was almost a catastrophe. The water was cold enough to remind me that I was 40, not 14, and for a moment my heart stopped dead in my chest. As Dark Score Lake closed over my head, I felt quite sure that I wasn't going to come up alive. I'd be found drifting face down between the swimming float and my little stretch of the street, a victim of cold water and a greasy village burger. They'd carve, "Your mother always said to wait at least an hour," on my tombstone. Then my feet landed in the stones and slimy weed stuff growing along the bottom. My heart kick-started, and I shoved upward like a guy planning to slam-dunk home the last score of a close basketball game. As I returned to the air, I gasped. Water went in my mouth, and I coughed it back out, patting one hand against my chest in an effort to encourage my heart. "Come on, baby, keep going. You can do it." I came back down, standing waist-deep in the lake, and with my mouth full of that cold taste. Lake water with an undertinge of minerals, the kind you'd have to correct for when you washed your clothes. It was exactly what I had tasted while standing on the shoulder of Route 68. It was what I had tasted when Maddie DeVore told me her daughter's name. I made a psychological connection, that's all. From the similarity of the names to my dead wife to this lake, which I have tasted a time or two before, I said out loud. As if to underline the fact, I scooped up a palm full of water, some of the cleanest and clearest in the state, according to the analysis reports I and all the other members of the so-called Western Lakes Association get each year, and drank it down. There was no revelation, no sudden weird flashes in my head. It was just Dark Score, first in my mouth and then in my stomach. I swam out to the float, climbed the 3-rung ladder on the side and flopped on the hot boards, feeling suddenly very glad I had come, in spite of everything. Tomorrow I would start putting together some sort of life down here, trying to anyway. For now it was enough to be lying with my head in the crook of one arm, on the verge of a doze, confident that the day's adventures were over. As it happened, that was not quite true. During our first summer in the TR, Joe and I discovered it was possible to see the Castle Rock's fireworks show from the deck overlooking the lake. I remembered this just as it was drawing down toward dark, and thought that this year I would spend that time in the living room, watching a movie on the video player, reliving all the 4th of July twilights we had spent out there, drinking beer and laughing as the big ones went off, would be a bad idea. I was lonely enough without that, lonely in a way of which I had not been conscious in Derry. Then I wondered what I had come down here for, if not to finally face Joanna's memory, all of it, and put it to loving rest. Certainly the possibility of writing again had never seemed more distant than it did that night. There was no beer. I'd forgotten to get a six-pack either at the general store or at the village cafe, but there was soda, courtesy of Brenda Meserve. I got a can of Pepsi and settled in to watch the light show, hoping it wouldn't hurt too much. Hoping, I supposed, that I wouldn't cry. Not that I was kidding myself. There were more tears here, all right. I'd just have to get through them. The first explosion of the night had just gone off, a spangly burst of blue with the bang traveling far behind, when the phone rang. It made me jump as the faint explosion from Castle Rock had not. I decided it was probably Bill Dean calling long distance to see if I was settling in all right. In the summer before Joe died, we'd gotten a wireless phone so we could prowl the downstairs while we talked, a thing we both liked to do. I went through the sliding door into the living room, punched the pickup button, and said, "Hello, this is Mike," as I went back to my deck chair and sat down. Far across the lake, exploding below the low clouds hanging over Castle View, were green and yellow starbursts, followed by soundless flashes that would eventually reach me as noise. For a moment there was nothing from the phone, and then a man's raspy voice, an elderly voice, but not Bill Dean, said,
"Noonan? Mr. Noonan?"
"Yes?" A huge spangle of gold lit up the west, shivering the low clouds with brief filigree. It made me think of the award shows you see on television, all those beautiful women in shining dresses.
"DeVore?"
"Yes," I said again, cautiously.
"Max DeVore."
"We don't see him in here too often," Audrey had said. I had taken that for Yankee wit, but apparently she'd been serious. Wonders never ceased. "Okay, what next?" I was at a total loss for conversational gambits. I thought of asking him how he'd gotten my number, which was unlisted, but what would be the point? When you were worth over $500 million, if this really was the Max DeVore I was talking to, you could get any old unlisted number you wanted. I settled for saying yes again, this time without the little up-tilt at the end. Another silence followed. When I broke it and began asking questions, he would be in charge of the conversation, if we could be said to be having a conversation at that point. A good gambit, but I had the advantage of my long association with Harold Oblowski to fall back on. Harold, master of the pregnant pause. I sat tight, cunning little cordless phone to my ear, and watched the show in the west. Red bursting into blue, green into gold. Unseen women walking the clouds in glowing award show evening dresses.
"I understand you met my daughter-in-law today," he said at last.
He sounded annoyed. "I may have done," I said, trying not to sound surprised. "May I ask why you're calling, Mr. DeVore?"
"I understand there was an incident."
White lights danced in the sky. They could have been exploding spacecraft. Then, trailing after, the bangs. I've discovered the secret of time travel, I thought. It's an auditory phenomenon. My hand was holding the phone far too tightly, and I made it relax. Maxwell DeVore, $500 million. Not in Palm Springs, as I had supposed, but close. Right here on the TR, if the characteristic underhum on the line could be trusted.
"I'm concerned for my granddaughter."
His voice was raspier than ever. He was angry, and it showed. This was a man who hadn't had to conceal his emotions in a lot of years.
"I understand my daughter-in-law's attention wandered again. It wanders often."
Now half a dozen colored starbursts lit the night, blooming like flowers in an old Disney nature film. I could imagine the crowds gathered on Castle View, sitting cross-legged on their blankets, eating ice cream cones and drinking beer and all going ooh at the same time. That's what makes any successful work of art, I think. Everybody goes ooh at the same time. "You're scared of this guy, aren't you?" Joe asked. "Okay, maybe you're right to be scared. A man who feels he can be angry whenever he wants to, at whoever he wants to, that's a man who can be dangerous." Then Maddie's voice. "Mr. Noonan, I'm not a bad mother. Nothing like this has ever happened to me before." Of course, that's what most bad mothers say in such circumstances, I imagined. But I had believed her. Also, God damn it, my number was unlisted. I had been sitting here with a soda, watching the fireworks, bothering nobody, and this guy had... "Mr. DeVore, I don't have any idea what..."
"Don't give me that. With all due respect, don't give me that, Mr. Noonan. You were seen talking to them."
He sounded as I imagined Joe McCarthy sounded to those poor schmucks who ended up being branded dirty commies when they came before his committee. "Be careful, Mike. Joe said. Beware of Maxwell's silver hammer. I did see and speak to a woman and a little girl this morning, I said. I presume they're the ones you're talking about.
No, you saw a toddler walking on the road alone, he said. And then you saw a woman chasing after her. My daughter-in-law and that old thing she drives. The child could have been run down. Why are you protecting that young woman, Mr. Noonan? Did she promise you something? You're certainly doing the child no favors, I can tell you that much.
She promised to take me back to her trailer and then take me around the world, I thought of saying. She promised to keep her mouth open the whole time if I'd keep mine shut. Is that what you want to hear? Yes, Joe said. Very likely that is what he wants to hear. Very likely what he wants to believe. Don't let him provoke you into a burst of your sophomore sarcasm, Mike. You could regret it. Why was I bothering to protect Maddie DeVore anyway? I didn't know. Didn't have the slightest idea of what I might be getting into here, for that matter. I only knew that she had looked tired, and the child hadn't been bruised or frightened or sullen. There was a car, an old Jeep.
That's more like it.
Satisfaction and sharp interest, greed almost.
What did...
I guess I assumed they came in the car together, I said. There was a certain giddy pleasure in discovering my capacity for invention had not deserted me. I felt like a pitcher who can no longer do it in front of a crowd, but who can still throw a pretty good slider in the old backyard. The little girl might have had some daisies. All the careful qualifications, as if I were testifying in court instead of sitting on my deck. Harold would have been proud. Well, no. Harold would have been horrified that I was having such a conversation at all. I think I assumed they were picking wildflowers. My memory of the incident isn't all that clear, unfortunately. I'm a writer, Mr. DeVore, and when I'm driving, I often drift off into my own private...
You're lying.
The anger was right out in the open now, bright and pulsing like a boil. As I had suspected, it hadn't taken much effort to escort this guy past the social niceties. Mr. DeVore. The computer DeVore, I assume?
You assume correctly.
Joe always grew cooler in tone and expression as her not inconsiderable temper grew hotter. Now I heard myself emulating her in a way that was frankly eerie. Mr. DeVore, I'm not accustomed to being called in the evening by men I don't know, nor do I intend to prolong the conversation when a man who does so calls me a liar. Good evening, sir.
If everything was fine, then why did you stop?
I've been away from the TR for some time, and I wanted to know if the Village Cafe was still open. Oh, by the way, I don't know where you got my telephone number, but I know where you can put it. Good night. I broke the connection with my thumb and then just looked at the phone as if I had never seen such a gadget in my life. The hand holding it was trembling. My heart was beating hard. I could feel it in my neck and wrists as well as my chest. I wondered if I could have told DeVore to stick my phone number up his ass if I hadn't had a few million rattling around in the bank myself. The Battle of the Titans, dear, Joe said in her cool voice, and all over a teenage girl in a trailer. She didn't even have any breasts to speak of. I laughed out loud. War of the Titans? Hardly. Some old robber baron from the turn of the century had said, these days a man with $1 million thinks he's rich. DeVore would likely have the same opinion of me, and in the wider scheme of things, he would be right. Now the western sky was alight with unnatural, pulsing color. It was the finale.
What was that all about?
I asked. No answer, only a loon calling across the lake, protesting all the unaccustomed noise in the sky, as likely as not. I got up, went inside, and put the phone back in its charging cradle, realizing as I did that I was expecting it to ring again, expecting DeVore to start spouting movie cliches. If you get in my way, I'll...
And I'm warning you, friend, not to... And... Let me give you a good piece of advice before you... The phone didn't ring.
I poured the rest of my soda down my gullet, which was understandably dry, and decided to go to bed. At least there hadn't been any weeping and wailing out there on the deck. DeVore had pulled me out of myself. In a weird way, I was grateful to him. I went into the north bedroom, undressed, and lay down. I thought about the little girl, Kyra, and the mother that could have been her older sister. DeVore was pissed at Maddie, that much was clear, and if I was a financial nonentity to the guy, what must she be to him? And what kind of resources would she have if he had taken against her? That was a pretty nasty thought, actually, and it was the one I fell asleep on. I got up 3 hours later to eliminate the can of soda I had unwisely downed before retiring, and as I stood before the bowl, pissing with one eye open, I heard the sobbing again. A child somewhere in the dark, lost and frightened, or perhaps just pretending to be lost and frightened. "Don't," I said. I was standing naked before the toilet bowl, my back alive with goose flesh. "Please don't start up with this shit. It's scary." The crying dwindled as it had before, seeming to diminish like something carried down a tunnel. I went back to bed, turned on my side, and closed my eyes. "It was a dream," I said. "Just another Manderley dream." I knew better, but I also knew I was going back to sleep, and right then that seemed like the important thing. As I drifted off, I thought in a voice that was purely my own, "She is alive. Sarah is alive." And I understood something, too. She belonged to me. I had reclaimed her. For good or ill, I had come home. At 9 o'clock the following morning, I filled a squeeze bottle with grapefruit juice and set out for a good long walk south along the street. The day was bright and already hot. It was also silent, the kind of silence you only experience after a Saturday holiday, I think, one composed of equal parts holiness and hangover. I could see two or three fishermen parked far out on the lake, but not a single powerboat bird. Not a single gaggle of kids shouted and splashed. I passed half a dozen cottages on the slope above me, and although all of them were likely inhabited at this time of year, the only signs of life I saw were bathing suits hung over the deck rail at the Passendales, and a half-deflated fluorescent green seahorse on the Reimer's stub of a dock. But did the Passendales' little gray cottage still belong to the Passendales? Did the Reimer's amusing circular summer house with its cinerama picture window pointing at the lake and the mountains beyond still belong to the Reimer's? No way of telling, of course. 4 years can bring a lot of changes. I walked and made no effort to think, an old trick from my writing days. Work your body, rest your mind, let the boys in the basement do their jobs. I made my way past camps where Joe and I had once had drinks and barbecues and attended the occasional card party. I soaked up the silence like a sponge. I drank my juice. I armed sweat off my forehead, and I waited to see what thoughts might come. The first was an odd realization that the crying child in the night seemed somehow more real than the call from Max DeVore. Had I really been phoned by a rich and obviously bad-tempered techno-mogul on my first full evening back on the TR? Had said mogul actually called me a liar at one point? I was, considering the tale I had told, but that was beside the point. I knew it had happened, but it was actually easier to believe in the ghost of Darkscore Lake, known around some campfires as the Mysterious Crying Kitty. My next thought, this was just before I finished my juice, was that I should call Maddie DeVore and tell her what had happened. I decided it was a natural impulse, but probably a bad idea. I was too old to believe in such simplicities as the damsel in distress versus the wicked stepfather, or in this case, father-in-law. I had my own fish to fry this summer, and I didn't want to complicate my job by getting into a potentially ugly dispute between Mr. Computer and Ms. Doublewide. DeVore had rubbed my fur the wrong way, and vigorously, but that probably wasn't personal, only something he did as a matter of course. Hey, some guy snapped bra straps. Did I want to get in his face on this? No, I did not. I had saved Little Miss Red Sox. I had gotten myself an inadvertent feel of Mom's small but pleasantly firm breast. I had learned that Kyra was Greek for ladylike. Any more than that would be gluttony, by God. I stopped at that point, feet as well as brain, realizing I'd walked all the way to Warrington's, a vast barnboard structure which locals sometimes called the country club. It was, sort of. There was a 6-hole golf course, a stable and riding trails, a restaurant, a bar, and lodging for perhaps 36 in the main building and the 8 or 9 satellite cabins. There was even a 2-lane bowling alley, although you and your competition had to take turns setting up the pins. Warrington's had been built around the beginning of World War I. That made it younger than Sarah Laughs, but not by much. A long dock led out to a smaller building called the Sunset Bar. It was there that Warrington's summer guests would gather for drinks at the end of the day, and some for Bloody Marys at the beginning. And when I glanced out that way, I realized I was no longer alone. There was a woman standing on the porch to the left of the floating bar's door, watching me. She gave me a pretty good jump. My nerves weren't in their best condition right then, and that probably had something to do with it, but I think she would have given me a jump in any case. Part of it was her stillness. Part of it was her extraordinary thinness. Most of it was her face. Have you ever seen that Edvard Munch drawing, The Scream? Well, if you imagined that screaming face at rest, mouth closed and eyes watchful, you'll have a pretty good image of the woman standing at the end of the dock with one long-fingered hand resting on the rail. Although, I must tell you that my first thought was not Edvard Munch, but Mrs. Danvers. She looked about 70 and was wearing black shorts over a black tank bathing suit. The combination looked strangely formal, a variation on the ever-popular little black cocktail dress. Her skin was cream white, except above her nearly flat bosom and along her bony shoulders. There it swam with large brown age spots. Her face was a wedge featuring prominent skull-like cheekbones and an unlined lamp of brow. Beneath that bulge, her eyes were lost in sockets of shadow. White hair hung scant and lank around her ears and down to the prominent shelf of her jaw. God, she's thin, I thought. She's nothing but a bag of... A shudder twisted through me at that. It was a strong one, as if someone were spinning a wire in my flesh. I didn't want her to notice it. What a way to start a summer day, by revolting a guy so badly that he stood there shaking and grimacing in front of you. So I raised my hand and waved. I tried to smile as well. Hello there, lady standing out by the floating bar. Hello there, you old bag of bones. You scared the living shit out of me, but it doesn't take much these days, and I forgive you. How the fuck you doing? I wondered if my smile looked as much like a grimace to her as it felt to me. She didn't wave back. Feeling quite a bit like a fool, there's no village idiot here, we all take turns. I ended my wave in a kind of half-assed salute and headed back the way I'd come. 5 steps, and I had to look over my shoulder. The sensation of her watching me was so strong it was like a hand pressing between my shoulder blades. The dock where she'd been was completely deserted. I squinted my eyes, at first sure she must have just retreated deeper into the shadow thrown by the little booze house, but she was gone, as if she had been a ghost herself. She stepped into the bar, hon, Joe said. You know that, don't you? I mean, you do know it, right? Right, right, I murmured, setting off north along the street toward home. Of course I do. Where else? Except it didn't seem to me that there had been time. It didn't seem to me that she could have stepped in, even in her bare feet, without me hearing her. Not on such a quiet morning. Joe again. Perhaps... she's stealthy. Yes, I murmured. I did a lot of talking out loud before that summer was over. Yes, perhaps she is. Perhaps she's stealthy. Sure, like Mrs. Danvers. I stopped again and looked back, but the right-of-way path had followed the lake around a little bit of curve, and I could no longer see either Warrington's or the Sunset Bar. And really, I thought, that was just as well.